Human Depravity, Part 2, the seventh talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 24, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're in Romans, crawling our way through Romans here. I want to get to what I have called paragraph 10, which is chapter 1, verses 22 to 27. I hope to get there eventually, and perhaps we'll even get further, but we'll see how it goes. But before I do that, there are about five things I want to talk about briefly that have come up in response to the previous weeks in questions or comments. So this is by way of review and elaboration on some points that we've already talked about. The first one is, as I suggested last week, the first chapter of Romans from 1:18 following could easily be construed to be something that's directed at Gentiles, pagans. The examples that are given for depravity, idolatry, and homosexuality would not have been practiced by the Jews of this time. So it, at kind of a superficial reading, you look at it and you go, well, this is the Gentiles that he's talking about here. This is the evidence of their evil. Excuse me. And so it invites the idea that Paul's argument goes something like this, that in what I call part three, Paul argues that mankind is evil and depraved and under the wrath of God, and we can see it in the case of the Gentiles because of their idolatry and homosexuality. And then in parts 4 through 7, I think it is, he turns to the Jews and says, you are evil and depraved and under the wrath of God, and that's evidenced by your transgression of the covenant. So the Gentiles have suppressed the truth, and arguably then the suppression of the truth is the fact that they've suppressed the truth about God. They don't even believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They've suppressed that. So the Gentiles are evil because of their suppression of the truth. The Jews are evil because of their transgression of the covenant. And now we've got everybody, Jew and Gentile, all understandably evil, depraved, and under the wrath of God. That's why we need Jesus. That's a very plausible, understandable construction of the argument, at least superficially. But what I want to contend is that I think that would miss the point, and that ultimately we have to decide that based on the larger structure of the argument, the larger flow of the argument, and that what he's doing in 4 through 7, I am going to go on to argue, and I'll try to demonstrate this when we get there, is that what he's going to do there is not argue that the Jews are evil and depraved and under the wrath of God. My contention is he already thinks he's made that point in part 3. From part 4 to part 7, what he's saying is, okay, given that Jew and Gentile alike, every human being on the planet is under the wrath of God, given that, how are we going to escape the wrath of God? And the Jews' presumption is, well, we will, because we are the chosen people of God. God has already chosen us. He's already declared his intention to show us mercy. So as long as I am a Jew in good standing, that's what should allow me to escape the wrath of God in the end. And then their contention is that their knowledge of the law, their circumcision, all those indicators of their specialness in God's eyes, those are the things that they're counting on to get them mercy in the final analysis. But it's mercy they're looking for, not somehow an exemption from the claim that they are depraved, because I don't think that's what's going on. So I'm going to argue that the larger argument needs 4 through 7 to not be talking about the Jews' depravity, but the Jews' presumption on the mercy of God, basically. And if you decide that 4 through 7 is talking about their depravity, then we're missing the larger piece that's necessary for Paul's argument to work. More immediately, if you'll notice, In paragraph 12 and 13, let's look at those for a second. That's two, chapter 2, 1 and 2 and following. So you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment. The interpretation that I am rejecting here, the idea that from part 4 and following he has turned and is talking to the Jews, that interpretation is likely going to include 12 with part 4 instead of part 3 as I have. So they see it as a new point where he's turned from the Gentiles to the Jews. So you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment. For insofar as you, the Jew, condemn the other person, the Gentile, you bring condemnation upon yourself. For the one who is passing judgment is practicing the very same things. And I want to highlight that, is practicing the very same things. And we know that the just sentence of God is rightly and truly upon those who are practicing such things. And then he goes on in 13, and I argue that he is now talking to the Jews. I think that's right. But do you suppose this, O man, when you pass judgment on those who practice such things and do the very same things, that you will escape the judgment of God? So in both cases, in both paragraphs, he identifies what it is that the Jew, if it is a Jew, is accountable for, why he's under the wrath of God, why he stands condemned. It's because he does the very same things that have been described throughout part 3. Now, one could certainly argue that, well, the same things is that list of things in paragraph 11 that we haven't got to yet, but all of us are going to recognize ourselves in paragraph 11. I mean, paragraph 11 is just generic, ordinary, plain vanilla sin that all of us know all too well. And so it could be that the very same things is referring back to that and not to the idolatry and homosexuality and so on. But the problem is that in large measure that's true. But the more we understand the argument of part 3, the argument of part 3 is mankind has suppressed the truth about God. In suppressing the truth about God, they also have been given over to degrading passions, to impurity, to a depraved mind. And what is the net result of having been given over to a depraved mind and degrading passions and impurity? All these evils that come out of that. So even if the same things that the Jews are practicing are these more ordinary, mundane, less spectacular and dramatic sins that are in paragraph 11, even so, the very structure of the argument of part 3 is there's this intimate connection, there's this intimate correlation between rejecting the truth about God, suppressing the truth about God, having impure desires and acting in all kinds of immoralities out of those impure desires. They're all connected, Paul is arguing. So if the Jews are practicing the very same things, it's because spiritually the dynamics of their life are exactly the same. They too have suppressed the truth. They too have rejected their Creator. They too are a seething cesspool of impurity and degrading passions, and they too have a mind that is a poor excuse for a mind because it can't think straight. So whatever is true of the pagans in part 3 is equally true of the Jews. And that's exactly Paul's point, because he intends all along for part 3 to be a description not of pagans, but a description of human beings, of mankind. Okay, that's that. Second point I want to make. If we look back at paragraph 9 for a second, we talked briefly about sentence 2, that's probably about 120 or so. From the creation of the cosmos, his invisible attributes are understood by way of the things he created. His eternal power and deity is clearly seen, with the result that they are without a defense. And we talked, I talked at some length about exactly what is Paul saying here. What's the relationship between nature, the cosmos, the created order, and our knowledge of God? I articulated this, but I'm not sure I did as good a job as this guy does. This is a book called The Gift of Fear, and I haven't actually read the book, but Christine Barber gave it to me because it he talks about intuition in here, and he does so in a very, very effective way, I think. So I want to read the first page and a half or 2 pages of this. This is chapter 2, The Technology of Intuition. I want to talk about intuition a little bit, because I think that's vital in understanding what Paul is saying here about our knowledge of God. To understand why he starts the way he does, this is about signals of fear and how helpful they are to us. That's what the book is about. I walked into that convenience store to buy a few magazines, and for some reason I was suddenly afraid, and I turned right around and walked out. I don't know what told me to leave, but later that day I heard about the shooting. Airline pilot Robert Thompson is telling me about dodging death right here on the ground. I asked him what he saw, what he reacted to. Nothing. It was just a gut feeling. A pause. Well, now that I think back, the guy behind the counter looked at me with a very rapid glance, just jerked his head toward me for an instant, and I guess I'm used to the clerk sizing you up when you walk in, but he was intently looking at another customer, and that must have seemed odd to me. I must have seen that he was concerned. When free of judgment, we inherently respect the intuition of others. Sensing that someone else is in that special state of assessing hazard, we are alerted, just as when we see the cat or dog awaken suddenly from a nap and stare intently into a dark hallway. Thompson continues, I noticed that the clerk was focused on a customer who was wearing a big heavy jacket, and of course I now realize that it was very hot, so that's probably where the guy was hiding the shotgun. Only after I saw on the news what kind of car they were looking for did I remember that there were two men sitting in a station wagon in the parking lot with the engine running. Now it's all clear, but it didn't mean a thing to me at the time. Actually, it did then too, I tell him. Combining what amounted to fear on the face of the clerk with the man in the heavy coat on the hot day, with the men in the car with its engine running, with Thompson's unconscious knowledge of convenience store robberies from years of news reports, with his unconscious memory of frequent police visits to that store, which he'd driven past hundreds of times, and with countless other things we might never discover about Thompson's experience and knowledge, it is no wonder he left that store just moments before a police officer happened in and was shot dead by a man he surprised in the middle of a robbery. What Robert Thompson and many others want to dismiss as a coincidence or a gut feeling is in fact a cognitive process, and that's the point I'm wanting to emphasize. It is in fact a cognitive process, faster than we recognize and far different from the familiar step-by-step thinking we rely on so willingly. We think conscious thought is somehow better, when in fact intuition is soaring flight compared to the plodding of logic. Nature's greatest accomplishment, the human brain, is never more efficient or invested than when its host is at risk. Then intuition is catapulted to another level entirely, a height at which it can accurately be called graceful, even miraculous. Intuition is the journey from A to Z without stopping at any other letter along the way. It is knowing without knowing why. At just the moment when our intuition is most basic, people tend to consider it amazing or supernatural. A woman tells a simple story as if it were mystical. I couldn't believe it. I absolutely knew when the phone rang that it would be my college roommate calling after all these years. Though people act as if predictions of who is calling are miraculous, they rarely are. In this case, her old roommate was reminded of her by reports of the explosion of the space shuttle. Is it a miracle that both women happened to watch the same news event along with a billion others? Is it a miracle that their strongest association with space travel was the angry belief they shared in college that women would never be astronauts? And a woman astronaut died in the space shuttle explosion that morning, and the two women thought of each other, even after a decade? These non-critical intuitions, which at first impress us, are often revealed to be somewhat rudimentary, especially in contrast to what the mind delivers when we might be in danger. A Natural History of the Senses author Diane Ackerman says, the brain is a good stagehand. It goes on with its work while we're busy acting out our scenes. When we see an object, the whole peninsula of our senses wakes up to appraise the new sight. All the brain's shopkeepers consider it from their point of view. All the civil servants, all the accountants, all the students, all the farmers, all the mechanics. we could add the soldiers and guards to Ackerman's list. For it is they who evaluate the context in which things occur, the appropriateness and significance of literally everything we sense. These soldiers and guards separate the merely unusual from the significantly unusual. They weigh the time of day, day of the week, loudness of the sound, quickness of the movement, flavor of the scent, smoothness of the surface, the entire mosaic of each moment. They discard the irrelevant and value the meaningful. They recognize the survival signals, but don't even consciously. They recognize survival signals. We don't even consciously know our signals. That's enough. But the point that I want to make in connection with what Paul is saying here is, I think this is exactly the kind of cognitive process that Paul has in mind here in Romans 1. I remember going to college. I barely remember going to college. I remember when I went to college for the first time, and I was beginning to study philosophy and history of Western civilization. We finally get to Aquinas's five ways, his five proofs for the existence of God. You know, and coming out of a fundamentalist background where every class, everything that I had been taught has been trashed over and over and over again. Oh, finally, someone proving the existence of God. And you get to Aquinas's five proofs and you go, really? That's why I believe in God? It just seems so anemic, so hollow, so weak, so inconsequential. And, you know, something inside me said, no, I don't think so. That's not why I believe in God. Now, granted, our philosophical arguments, our formal arguments are an attempt to formally capture an intuition that we have. But as he so eloquently puts it in here, all the data that is going into my intuition is much vaster than the data that I can consciously identify and articulate when I make my argument. He goes on in the chapter to describe how often people will often talk themselves out of their hunches and their gut feelings, because when they start trying to articulate to themselves, they're not convinced by their own argument. They're not convinced by their own articulation. And so we kind of dismiss it as, well, I guess I was being irrational or silly or, you know, something. And we blow it off, because when I try to articulate the basis for my conclusion, I'm not convinced by my own articulate argument for the conclusion. Well, the same thing is true with respect to the existence of God. The created order demands that we recognize and acknowledge the mind and the power and the force behind this reality. And we take in all kinds of information all day long unconsciously and process it and come up with our hunch, our conclusion, our intuition. When we try to articulate it, it just doesn't seem to quite capture what it is that we believe and why we believe it. But it is an utterly rational process. In fact, I would argue it's a process of inference. We are inferring the existence of God from the nature of reality. Third point, in this section, there's this repetition of God abandoning mankind, abandoning them to impurity in their desires of their heart, abandoning them to degrading passions, abandoning them to a depraved mind. And as I said last week, I think it's a mistake that I made for years, but I think it's a mistake to see the abandoning of us as being the wrath of God that he starts to talk about in this section. Rather, the wrath of God is the final, ultimate judgment that we all face. When God objectifies his wrath, we will be destroyed, we will be condemned, unless he decides to act in mercy toward us instead. And that becomes the whole crux of the issue. Who is going to receive mercy? We all deserve condemnation. Who is going to receive mercy? So what is all the abandoning to these things all about? It's because Paul is trying to emphasize that God did not step in and immediately fix mankind when we rebelled. You know, the minute we rebelled, God could have said, enough of that. Go out of existence. Stop. I'm going to recreate another human being who'll get it right. He could have fixed it that way. But he didn't fix us. He let our rebellion run its course. And the story of history, the drama of history, the reality of history is human evil rooted in its rebellion against the Creator, running its course and working its way out to its natural results and natural consequences. And God abandoned us to that, knowing full well what it would lead to. God, in his purposes, decided to let human evil run its course, and he would deal with it in another way. Fourthly, I just mentioned briefly that I don't think Paul is giving us a historical account here of where sin came from and how it evolved. I know it kind of reads that way, and it's very tempting to think that Paul is just describing the course of human history and the dynamics of human history and how sin came to be and grow and develop and go to its natural conclusion. One of the difficulties, one of the problems is if you take it that way, then you are tempted to see idolatry and homosexuality as the very depths of human depravity. And I don't think that's what he's saying. He's not saying that idolatry and homosexuality are the utter depths of human depravity. Other things are equally depraved, equally low, equally base. And in any case, how would Paul know? How would Paul be able to tell that story? He hasn't been there in human history. So I think we have to understand what he's doing and the genre of what he's doing. This is a story he's telling, a story intended to explain the relationships and the correlations between various realities. The relationship and correlation between rejecting the Creator, suppressing the truth, impure desires and degrading passions, and a depraved mind, and showing the interconnectedness and the inner correlations between all of those realities. That's what he's trying to accomplish, not to tell us the history of the evolution of evil. There are times when I'm teaching epistemology that I will tell a story something like this. Let me read it to you. One day when we were merely infants lying in the crib, we looked up out of the crib and we saw this strange pattern that looked vaguely, inexplicably familiar. Time after time, we saw the same pattern. It always seemed to be there day after day. Now, we could have decided that it was just a very remarkable coincidence, a mere freak of statistics, that the same visual pattern kept emerging in the field of our perception, but we didn't. We knew that the only logical explanation was that there was some constant fixed reality lying behind that visual pattern. Accordingly, we decided that it was worth paying attention to and worth coming to understand. Ultimately, we learned that it was our mother's face leaning over us. Now, I would hope it's obvious that that's not a literal historical account of the inner reasonings of an infant, not of me or anybody else. But although it's not a literal historical account, it does capture what I believe are the logical relationships that exist between the infant's experience, the infant's God-given common sense, and the infant's growth in knowledge, that we can begin to see the interconnectedness there. That's what I'm arguing Paul is doing here, by analogy. Paul's account does not offer us a historical account of the progress and development of human immorality, but it does capture the natural relationships that exist between the human being's animosity toward his Creator, the human being's suppression of truth, his propensity toward wrong desires, and his propensity toward wrong beliefs and perceptions. And that's what Paul is setting out to do, is to explain that dynamic and the structure of those relationships, not to give us a literal historical account. It's important to recognize that, because if we don't understand the genre of a passage and an argument, we will draw wrong conclusions and inferences from it. So we always, in the process of interpretation, we always have to get the genre right in order to know what we can and cannot conclude or infer. And then finally, what Paul is and is not saying in part three. I don't think that Paul is saying that the suppression of truth is caused by human immorality, or for that matter, that human immorality has caused the suppression of truth. I don't think he's pretending to make such a distinction. Rather, what he's saying is that the suppression of truth and immorality are naturally correlated with one another. Ultimately, I think what Paul is arguing in this section is that there's some common root to all these things: the rejection of the Creator, the suppression of all truth, degrading passions, impurity, wrongheadedness. They all are rooted in exactly the same thing, this core, fundamental, underlying wrongness of us as human beings. We're just wrong. And that wrongness expresses itself and works itself out in all those ways. Okay, so before I get into this next paragraph here, what's the point of part three again, just as a reminder? Paul's point in part three is that due to mankind's innate, intractable opposition to God, and due to the moral depravity that flows from and is correlated to that, every human being stands without excuse under the judgment and wrath of God. The logical rhetorical point that motivates Paul to make this point here is that he wants to emphasize the truth that it is only by mercy that any human being will ever be able to enter into eternal life. Only by mercy. Since every human being stands justly condemned and without excuse under the divine wrath, it follows that unless there is a condition under which God will grant life to someone as an act of mercy, then no human being can possibly attain life. He needs to make that point because ultimately the point that he wants to make is that Jesus and Jesus alone is the way in which God has provided for mankind to escape mercy, and that obedience to the covenant has nothing to do with it. Because that's ultimately where he's headed, is if we have come to Jesus and are believers in Jesus, do we also have to keep the Sabbath? Do we also have to be circumcised? Do we also have to keep the dietary regulations? Do I have to live like a Jew to be saved as a disciple of Jesus? And Paul's argument here in Romans, I'm going to argue, is no, you don't. Jesus takes care of everything, and the covenant never has, and in of itself, the obedience to the covenant never has and never will be the terms upon which God will grant mercy. That's why understanding these next following sections is crucial, because I will argue that in part 4 through 7, Paul's whole point is to say it never has been the case that Jews are justified in God's eyes by their covenant keeping. That never has been true. And it's never has been necessary for someone to keep the covenant in order to be justified. So coming to Jesus changes that. Now that you believe in Jesus, you have to be a Jew to be saved? That makes no sense, because when you didn't believe in Jesus, you didn't have to be a Jew to be saved. So how can that make any sense? That's another story. We'll get there. Okay, so paragraph 10 now. Claiming to be wise, they responded like ignorant fools and swapped the glory of the incorruptible God for an image that was the representation of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed beasts and of crawling reptiles. For this very reason, God abandoned them to impurity and the desires of their hearts, with the result that they dishonored their bodies among themselves. These very people swapped the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who, it is certainly so, is eternally praiseworthy. On account of this, God gave them over to degrading passions. In fact, their women, on the one hand, swapped their natural desire for sexual intimacy for one that was against nature. Similarly, the men also, forsaking their natural desire for sexual intimacy with women, were consumed by their lust toward one another, males committing a shameful act with males, and were bringing upon themselves the penalty that was required of their error. Okay, we'll stop there. I think the way to understand this paragraph is that he basically repeats himself. He says exactly the same thing twice. He starts by describing the act of sinful mankind. The act of sinful mankind was to suppress the truth, ignore the truth, disregard the truth about who God was, and make up stories for themselves about what ultimate reality was all about instead. So he begins with that. Claiming to be wise, they responded like ignorant fools and swapped the glory of the incorruptible God for an image that was the representation of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed beasts and of crawling reptiles. So they became idolaters. Rebellious man chose idolatry over true worship of the true God. Well, when he's done making his point, he repeats that then starting in sentence 3. These very people swapped, he uses the same verb, these very people swapped the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who it is certainly so is eternally praiseworthy. So, in the consecutive repetitive sections, he begins by describing their idolatry. Then the next thing he does is describe the divine response to their idolatry. After one, describing their idolatry, sentence two begins, "For this very reason, God abandoned them to impurity in the desires of their hearts." So how did God respond? He didn't stop them. He didn't fix them. He didn't annihilate them. He didn't erase them. He just let it go. He abandoned them to the impurity in the desires of their hearts. And what I'm going to argue is the impurity in the desires of their heart is a natural correlate to their idolatry, to their rejection of their Creator. The same pattern after three. After three, he describes their idolatry. Then sentence four, on account of this, how did God respond? God gave them over to degrading passions. So they chose idolatry over the truth. God responded by letting it go, letting it run its course. And then finally, in both cases, he describes the net result of God abandoning them, letting it run its course, and describing what the natural result, the net effect of it running its course came to. It's the second part of sentence two. For this reason, God abandoned them to impurity and the desires of their hearts, with the result that, here's the third part, with the result that they dishonored their bodies among themselves, whatever that means. And then in the second half of this paragraph, after describing their idolatry, and then in four, describing the divine response, he describes the net result, much more detail now, in five and following. In fact, their women on the one hand swapped their natural desire for sexual intimacy for one that was against nature. Similarly, the men also, forsaking their natural desire for sexual intimacy with women, were consumed by their lust toward one another, males committing a shameful act with males, and were bringing upon themselves the penalty that was required of their error. So, one of the reasons it's significant that we see the parallel, see the repetition, exactly the same point made twice, just a mirror image of the first half of the paragraph, is that it helps us understand what he means, and two, by with the result that they dishonored their bodies among themselves. Because 5 through 6 is describing exactly the same thing, the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, namely their homosexuality. So what's the point of the paragraph? The nature of mankind is such that in their unrighteous rebellion against their Creator, they didn't acknowledge their Creator as God and respond in gratitude. Rather, what did they do? They told themselves stories that allowed them to avoid acknowledging God. God didn't respond by stopping mankind in his rebellion. Rather, God allowed man's rebellion to run its course. And the end result of human rebellion running its course, leading to its natural outcome, included things like intellectually inadequate idolatry and perversely unnatural homosexuality. That was the net result, the natural outcome of human evil running its course. And I think in part, you know, we could ask the question, why show us the idolatry and the homosexuality? I think Paul's purpose is that when we see the natural end of human rebellion in all of its shamelessness, those behaviors make it evident how foolish, how evil, how perverse, and therefore how wrong human beings are, and therefore how indeed worthy of the wrath of God we are. I think that's the rhetorical purpose for drawing our attention to that. As I said in the past weeks, it's very important that we understand that Paul is not attempting to prove that mankind is evil. He's asserting that mankind is evil, not proving it. So by claiming that some people are not idolaters and homosexuals doesn't serve as any kind of counterargument to Paul. It can't be a counterargument because he's not making an argument. He's not proving anything. He's just claiming it. He's asserting human evil and then giving us examples and illustrations of its expression when it has been led to its natural result. One of the implications of understanding the passage this way, then, is that nothing in Paul's argument implies that homosexuality is any more perverse or any more reprehensible than any other form of human perversity. I think it's important to see that. So, for example, homosexuality is not more reprehensible than idolatry. He's mentioning them in one breath. Now, having said that, The objection that could be raised, and many of you will feel this, but it feels so different. Idolatry doesn't feel debauched and perverse and debasing in the same way that homosexuality does. I want to respond to that in a second, but I want to acknowledge, there's a reason why that's the case. But it's important to not allow my kind of my negative feelings, my negative emotional response to homosexuality to dictate my intellectual understanding of it. What Paul is giving me as a way to understand homosexuality is that it is perverse just like everything else in human existence. The perversity manifests itself in any number of different ways, homosexuality being one of them. So, on the one hand, I'm going to argue that Paul's argument implies that it is no more perverse, no more reprehensible than any other form of human evil, on the one hand. On the other hand, nothing in Paul's argument suggests that homosexuality is anything other than totally and completely perverse. In fact, his argument requires that. To that, people, especially these days, will object, but for some people, it feels so natural. It doesn't feel wrong or perverse to them. It feels so natural. But we shouldn't be overly impressed by that. We have to come to realize how malleable human conscience is. Now, I'm using the word conscience here the way we typically use the word conscience, not the way the New Testament uses the word conscience. So whenever you see an English translation using the word conscience in the New Testament, don't automatically read your conception of conscience into that, because it doesn't mean that. Conscience, as we're using it, doesn't really get talked about a lot in the New Testament, and when it does, the word conscience is not used to describe it. It's some other language, some other permutation. But I'm using conscience now the way we typically use the word conscience. Those feelings of guilt, those feelings of shame, that psycho-emotional reaction that we have in response to a moral judgment towards something. Well, the thing we need to realize is how malleable human conscience is. It can be molded, it can be shaped, it can be fashioned, it can be made callous, it can be made more tender. And in the final analysis, it just depends on what's done a number on me, what I do and do not feel a conscience toward. If through the suppression of truth we stop making a particular moral judgment, then over time we can learn to stop feeling guilty by or repulsed by the corresponding behavior. We can train our conscience to shut up and to be silent. I am absolutely convinced that the slaveholder in the antebellum South felt that slavery was the most natural condition for the African. The poor African needed the enlightened, noble white man to take care of him. And it just felt so natural to him. He had been enculturated into that way of thinking. Those were the very lenses that he looked at life through. He didn't have to be an utterly twisted, evil individual to think that way. His whole culture had set him up to think of that as so natural. I would imagine, never had this experience, but I would imagine that cannibals feel toward eating non-tribe members the same way that some of us feel toward eating beef. It seems entirely natural. A pathological liar will lie to you as naturally as he will breathe. That whatever our conscious feelings are, I won't speak to the unconscious, but whatever our conscious feelings are, we can shape and mold our emotional responses in such a way that any number of things can feel natural to us, but it doesn't make it so. We have to make the judgment of what is right and wrong, what is good and bad, natural and unnatural, on some other basis other than what my conscience feels about it or toward it. So what I will contend that this paragraph suggests is that our attitude toward homosexual behavior should be just like our attitude toward any other sinful behavior. On the one hand, we should renounce it. Secondly, we should commit ourselves to striving to avoid it. And thirdly, we should ask God for mercy if and when we fail. That it's no different, it's no better, it's no more allowable, it's no more excusable, it's no more tolerable than any other sin in our lives. But it's no worse either. It's just human rebellion against God manifesting itself in a particular way. Okay, let's look at some of the particulars of this section then. Claiming to be wise, notice that in our rejection of God, at the same time that we're rejecting the truth about God, we're copying an attitude about it. We're claiming to be the wise ones, the one who know better, the ones who are more enlightened, not those poor benighted fundamentalists who actually believe in God. No, we are the wise ones. And claiming to be wise, they responded like ignorant fools and swapped the glory of the incorruptible God for an image that was the representation of corruptible man. What does he mean by the glory of the incorruptible God? That sounds like a weird thing to call God at first blush, but I think it really makes sense. The incorruptible God is the God who is eternal, the God who's undiminished and not diminishable in his power, in his glory, in his wisdom, or for that matter, any of his other attributes. He can't be detracted from. No other force, no other reality can make him other than the transcendent, eternal, powerful, glorious God that he is. He's irresistible. He's unbeatable. Nothing is a match for him. He's the force behind all of reality that always will be and never can not be. That's the incorruptible God, I would think. So the glory of the incorruptible God is just the awesomeness, the spectacular awesomeness of being that kind of being. So Paul here in 10:1 is describing the absurd reality of polytheistic idolatry. That what we've done is we've taken this God that we should have intuitively grasped is the mind and being behind all of reality, just by looking at the created order. That's the obvious conclusion that should impact us. But what did we do? We suppressed that truth and told ourselves stories about what ultimate reality must really actually be. It's not God, so it must be something else. And the pagans described it in terms of various gods and goddesses, and they made images of those gods and goddesses that had the form of animals, people, combination of them. Now, on the one hand, it's easy for us at this point in history to think that what Paul is saying is, isn't that cute? Isn't that silly? Their God is an alligator. And on the surface, that may seem plausible. But pagans were intellectually sophisticated individuals, and Paul had to know that. I mean, that Paul is not just rejecting them because they symbolize their God in a particular way. We symbolize our God. That's not idolatry. It's not an idolatry to have a word for God that we write, that we speak, that we utter. But God, the word God represents the transcendent being. But I'm not to be blamed because I represent it to myself. Well, the pagans with their images and their idols and so on, they didn't believe that that piece of metal or that piece of stone or that inscription was their God. They weren't worshiping the sign, the symbol. They were worshiping the reality behind the symbol. So what's Paul's problem? If they weren't as silly as it sounds like they were, what was his problem? His problem was that our signs and our symbols and so on tell us something about our conception of the gods. And basically, by representing gods to themselves through images of people and animals and various things in nature, they were basically saying that nature and the forces of nature are ultimate. The gods and goddesses that lie behind these images are just part of the cosmos, that are the reality-shaping forces back there in and around and through this cosmos. And Paul is going, really? This cosmos can be really adequately explained in terms of the everyday forces that determine our lives and affect our lives? Wind and rain and lightning and earthquakes and volcanoes and sun and moon and this and that and stars. Really? That's as ultimate as you can go? Because what Paul is understanding here is the truth that we've suppressed is that there is a mind, a being, a reality that's more ultimate than anything that our eyes can see and anything that we experience in our lives. Everything else in our lives, all the other realities and forces, are just tools in the hands of the God who really is there. They are subject to him. They have no independence. They have no will of their own. They have no reality of their own. They wouldn't even exist if the transcendent mind and author of all reality did not will them into existence. And we're calling them God? We're calling them the ultimate reality? That's the absurdity that he thinks exists in polytheism. For us, we suppress the truth and tell ourselves the same stories. We're just a little bit more 21st century about it. What are the ultimate realities for us? Matter, energy, chance, nature, natural processes. Paul would have exactly the same problem with that he had with the pagan idolatry. It's the same mistake. It's mistaking the creature for the creator. It's swapping the glory of the creator for the glory of the creature, of the creation. Yeah, of course matter and energy are important. Of course nature is a big deal. Of course natural processes are a big deal. They make the Grand Canyon and Mount Shasta and all kinds of cool, groovy stuff. Of course they're amazing. They're magnificent. But they're only a function of the will of the author of reality, God, a transcendent being, a transcendent reality. And we mustn't take their glory and say that's good enough when there's the glory of God himself that we need to honor, acknowledge, and respond to with gratitude and desire to serve. Okay, I'm going to skip here then. Let's look then at, he said the result of this natural process was the dishonoring of their bodies, and then he goes on to describe at the end of the paragraph homosexual practices. Why is homosexual behavior a matter of dishonoring their bodies? What is he getting at, I think? I don't think that Paul's point is that homosexual practice dishonors one's body uniquely. I think what he's getting at is that all sexually perverse behavior dishonors one's body. And homosexuality is just one example of sexual perversion itself. But sexual perversion, I think Paul would argue, it does have a unique feature to it. sexual perversion is dishonoring in a way that other kinds of perversions are not. I think that's what Paul is getting at in 1 Corinthians, I think it's chapter 6, it might be chapter 7, when he said every sin that a person commits is, should have written it down, outside the body. But fornication is, what, against the body, something like that? Inside the body. I think they're unusual prepositions, as I recall. It's exo and aso or something like that. I don't remember. Go check it out. But the point is, that's a very, very cryptic statement, but I think it's getting at the same thing that Paul is getting at here. All other sins are perverse. They are a twisted form of being a human being. Lying, cheating, being disloyal, being cruel, being unkind, lacking in compassion. All those things are perverse. That we ought not to be those kinds of beings. We ought not to be those kinds of creatures. That's not what we were made for. We weren't made for the kind of selfishness that our whole lives reek of. We weren't made for that. It's perverse that we are as selfish as we are, as acquisitive and as grasping as we are. All the things that are wrong with us are perverse. But when we pervert our sexuality, something interesting happens that has an interesting psychological effect on us. Namely, when we are sexually perverse, we make ourselves subject. Most sexual perversion is a function of allowing ourselves to be given over to our desires and our passions. Now, the fact of the matter is, we are a strange creation. We are a whole lot animal, and yet we were created to not live like animals. So we have the hormones and the body chemistry and therefore the impulses and the instincts and all the kind of stuff that is true of the animal kingdom. That's true. We experience all of that. But God's intention was for the human being to be different, that regardless of what kind of pressures and drives and feelings might be pressing on me from the out inside, I have a mind that can make moral judgment that says, but that would be wrong. That would be unkind. That would be unloving. That would be, you know, whatever. And to pass moral judgment on the very desires that are driving me and say no to them. Say, I know you're there. I hear you knocking, but you can't come in. I know you're there, but I am not going to gratify you. I am not going to fulfill you as a desire because that would be wrong. And that was the intended nobility of the human creature, to be able to rise above and beyond his mere animal nature and not live like an animal, not be that animal. So any time that we give ourselves over to those animal instincts that accompany our sexuality, any time we give ourselves over to those impulses and those drives and those desires and instincts and just go with it, we experience ourselves as acting like an animal. I am not acting out of the nobility that God created me to act out of. I'm not acting as the moral being that God created me to be. I'm not acting with the dignity that God intended me to live with. I am instead simply a servant, a slave of desire and passion. And I think that's what Paul means by dishonoring their bodies. They turn their physicality, their materiality, and its sexuality into simply one more animal among animals following his desires and following his instincts. And that dishonors what God made me to be, what God intended me to be. So I commented earlier that homosexuality feels different than idolatry. It seems like it is more debasing and shameful than idolatry. The feeling that we have is, I think, that feeling that always, until we suppress it and change it, that feeling that always accompanies this dishonoring of our bodies that is inherent in the very act of any sexual perversion, I think. Okay, I'm going to run out of time here. Let me just make one last comment then, and we'll call it a morning. I know, given the current climate in America today, and I'm wanting to get this sermon in before it becomes a federal offense for me to say the things I'm saying here. Given the culture today, it's commonplace for people to look at Romans 1 and completely dismiss this along the lines of, oh, he's not talking about homosexuality here. Paul doesn't have any problem with homosexuality. This is a special kind of homosexuality. This is a loveless homosexuality, a homosexuality that doesn't involve commitment, a homosexuality that involves huge age differences where there's a power differential and it's one person exploiting another. They have any number of explanations for the real sin that Paul is pointing to is not homosexuality per se. The real sin that he's pointing to is something else. We have to be very, very disciplined and approach with humility and integrity the Bible when it comes to supplying background information to a text. And you have to be on the alert and suspicious when anyone comes along and supplies background information to a text. With the right kind of background information, I can totally transform what any passage means to make it say the opposite of what the author intended, with the right kind of background information. And with the right kind of background information and you not paying too close attention. Require, when someone comes along and claims that there's background information, require that the background information truly elucidate and illuminate the meaning of the passage that otherwise would be opaque to you. Because whenever what I'm lacking is the right kind of background information, I'm going to find all kinds of statements in the context that are kind of cryptic and inexplicable, and why did he say that, and where's that coming from, and I don't even know what that means. It'll be full of those kinds of statements. And then when you reconstruct the right kind of background, all of a sudden, all of those begin to make sense. Oh, that's why he said that. Oh, that's what that means. That makes sense. None of that is here in Romans 1. There's nothing cryptic. There's nothing inexplicable. There's nothing problematic in any statement that he makes in this paragraph. It's perfectly clear what he's saying. And so when someone comes along with background and says, oh, but what's clear that he's saying, he's not saying at all, he's saying something radically different than that, because let me give you some background here, that should be highly suspect to you. It's incredibly irresponsible, I mean, yea, even immoral, for people to do that, because the truth is you can't understand any passage apart from the right background to the passage. That's true. Absolutely true. And there are places where reconstructing the background is going to make all the difference in the world to you getting what the actual point of the passage is. And the problem of kind of the literalistic interpretation of the Bible that you find in more fundamentalistic circles is that it's completely insensitive to that. It wants to say, no, don't give me no background, just read the words. Just read the words. It says it right here. That is utterly, utterly naive, utterly inappropriate to dismiss that as a possibility. We can't dismiss that as a possibility. So when someone comes along knowing that I shouldn't be dismissing that as a possibility and then uses that against me to lead me to take a passage that means X and turn it into something that means not X, that is utterly irresponsible and evil, because it's playing on something true. It's working off of a foundation that's true that we shouldn't reject. But that's not what's going on here. Paul's whole emphasis here is not, it's not wrong because it's unloving. It's not wrong because there's an age differential. It's not wrong because it's sexual slavery. Why do we have no hint of any of those things if that's supposedly the background? What he says explicitly 2 or 3 times here is because it's unnatural. It's because it's unnatural that we know that it's perverse, that we know that it's depraved. I confronted this years ago, way back in the 60s. There was a lesbian from San Francisco who came and spoke at our university group at Stanford when I was there. And it was very challenging at the time because I was just, you know, I didn't know how to use the Bible. I didn't know how to think about the Bible. But even back then, it occurred to me what a strange argument she was making, because this is Paul. Paul was a Pharisee of Pharisees who was steeped in the Mosaic Covenant. He knew the Mosaic Covenant, that same covenant that says it is an abomination for a male to lie with a male as with a female. That's in the covenant. That's the covenant that Paul has been trained by. Now, could Jesus come and change the rules, which is what some people are suggesting? Yeah, Jesus could come and change the rules. That's true. Did Paul ever reinterpret parts of the covenant? And yeah, he did. The Sabbath in the Old Covenant doesn't play the same role as it does in Jesus. Dietary regulations don't play the same role when you believe in Jesus that they did in the Mosaic Covenant. And so the argument could be made, same with homosexuality. It used to be wrong in the Old Covenant, but not so much anymore now that Jesus has come. The problem is, in the case of the dietary regulations and the Sabbath and circumcision and any of those things where Jesus and Paul leave behind certain elements of the Mosaic Covenant, they have an explanation, and they feel the need to give you an explanation. They feel that you deserve an explanation, because it shouldn't be obvious that something that's in the Mosaic Covenant can be disregarded if you're a Jew. It shouldn't be obvious. So they feel like they need to give you some kind of explanation for why they were merely shadows, why they are no longer valid, why they are no longer appropriate. We never have that with homosexuality. Paul never comes along and says, let me explain why the prohibition against homosexuality in the Old Covenant is merely a shadow of things to come, and that the things to come here, once we understand the things to come, we can leave behind and cast in the shadows the rules in the Old Covenant. Paul, of all people, would have felt the need to have that kind of explanation, because he was so thoroughly and completely and utterly Jewish, steeped in the Mosaic Covenant. But all he ever does is simply repeat the same injunctions against the unnaturalness of homosexuality, and simply repeat that as a sign of our depravity, of human depravity. Okay, I probably should say more, but let me leave time for your comments and questions.
Thank you, Jack. That was awesome. I can't wait to listen to it again. I'm glad we're recording these. It's really great. I have a friend who lives back east who listens to this stuff all the time, so he tells me how much he appreciates it, too. So
thank you.
I am wondering about the very last sentence, or partial sentence, in Section 10. We're bringing upon themselves the penalty...
Yes.
That was required of their error. I know some people kind of take that and run with it.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
regard to certain things like AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's what it's saying. So
right.
What do you have any thoughts about what that is?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, it's such a non sequitur in this passage. What makes the most sense in the context is the penalty that was required of their error is the wrath of God. That is the penalty required for every error of every human being, and that he's just saying, so what is it that is the result then of this practice of homosexuality? Then that wrath of God that I was talking about in paragraph 8, they're bringing upon themselves that penalty because that's the penalty required of this error. But I don't think he's intending to single that out as if that has an error attached to it that everything else he's talking about does not have attached to it. I don't think that's his point. I think he's just stressing the wrath of God being the result.
Okay.
So when it says in their own persons, I mean, that doesn't say that in your translation, but in many translations it says they receive in their own persons or even in their own body. Does that, how do you?
Boy, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I thought about that when I was translating it, and I just decided that that's to misunderstand what he's doing there. Let me look that up for you, because I need to go back and refresh my thinking about that. That's a good question.
In paragraph 10, how you divided, you said you're saying the same thing twice. In sentence 2, he says, for this very reason, God abandoned, and then sentence 4, on account of this. It seems like he's setting up a causal relationship. Because they did all this, therefore he abandoned them. But you were saying it's not the wrath. God abandoning them is not the wrath, but it seems like
right. It's
a punishment. The abandonment is a punishment.
Yeah. Maybe I should have rendered the translation a little bit differently there. What's really difficult in Greek is to get exact. The more I study, the more I translate, the more I admire the English language. I know there people have said exactly the opposite, and they've talked about what a perfect language Koine Greek was for God to reveal his word in, because it is so precise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nonsense. I mean, that's just garbage. English would have been a much better language to use for a variety of reasons. But English, I want to read. There's a book on the history of English I want to read, because if the genius of English is that it keeps stealing from other languages. So it incorporates Latin and Greek and it loan words from all kinds of different cultures and so on. We're not afraid to take anything that works and make it a part of our language. And as such, the English language has grown into a very, very rich and textured and flexible language where we can create all kinds of subtle nuances that, frankly, Koine Greek can't do, not in my experience of it. So it's got these very limited number of conjunctions and limited number of prepositions that it has to use to do all the work of saying anything a human being would want to say. So if we translate it too mechanically and too woodenly, you do things like I just did here for this very reason. Well, is that exactly what he's saying? I mean, we know what we expect in our English idiom, and it is, as you suggest, we're talking about some kind of causal relationship. Well, that's the very thing I'm denying that he's saying. I don't think that's right. And what we need to do is rethink the Greek conjunction here and what the range of possibilities are on what it can mean. So in the final analysis, there probably would be a better way, a less misleading way to translate that.
We'll fix that for next time.
Yeah. I think in a looser translation I had, I translated it differently, and when I, for our purposes, I wanted to make it a more strictly literal translation, and when I start doing that, I start going to the grammar's meanings of these conjunctions and so on.
Thanks, Jack. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd like to talk about the rationality of abandoning relationships.
I'm sorry, of what?
To talk about the rationality of abandoning relationships.
The rationality of abandoning?
Of God abandoning
relationships. Oh, okay, yeah, right.
We're through, Jack. I don't want anything to do with it. I mean, I've been in hurtful relationships where to stay in the relationship means that you have to agree with the terms of that relationship. So the terms of the relationship are that I'm bad and that they're good, that I'm wrong, that they're right, that my feelings are not important, that their feelings are important. And the exchange the truth for a lie by saying, well, it isn't the fact that I'm abusive to you. The problem is that you're ungrateful. If you would be more grateful, then I would be less abusive. And at some point in the relationship, I, quote, abandon the relationship. Because for me to stay in the relationship means I have to agree with the terms of that relationship. I have to act more grateful. I have to act bad. I have to act less than. So what does abandoning mean? Well, it means that I stop being the voice of reason to them. I stop saying, but that's not right. This is what's right. And I'm wondering if that is sort of the tense. And abandoning the relationship for me is not punishing them. I'm going to teach you a lesson by not talking to you ever again. I just refuse to agree with the terms of that relationship by becoming less than. And I'm wondering if that is kind of the tense in which God says, well, for me to stay in this relationship means that I have to agree that what you're doing is okay. Mm-hmm. And that the way you're relating to me is okay. And I'm unwilling to do that because that's not, I would have to become less than. And so I just give you over to the way you think. Mm-hmm. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think there are some important parallels. And that what you've just described describes in a very poignant kind of way how a way in which it would be helpful to think about what God is doing. But I do think we need to limit it to it would be a helpful way to think about what God is doing, because in the final analysis, there's a difference between a human-on-human relationship and a creator-to-creature relationship. Because the creature has resources that we don't have, you know, has vast resources. Did I say creature? I meant creator. The creator has vast resources that we don't have to solve the relationship problem in another way. And I think Paul's point here is he didn't use those. He didn't resort to those resources. He decided instead to make this a being-on-being relationship and let me go. Only to respond later to who I am. So given that he has, in that sense, self-limited himself by abandoning me to it, then what you go on to describe becomes a very helpful analog to, I think, our relationship to the Creator.
Thanks, Jack. That was great. When talking about sexual perversion, it was very intriguing to me, the idea about it being unique and about it being sort of against the body as opposed to other sins being outside the body. And I'm wondering what your perspective is on the relationship between addictive behaviors like drugs and alcohol addiction, gambling, those kind of things. What's your perspective on the relationship with the against the body kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's a good question. It would seem like there's some important parallels because any sort of addictive behavior is I experience myself as being a slave to my own being instead of the master of my own being. And so I think sexual perversion as well as other kind of addictive behaviors are going to ultimately have the effect of tempting me to self-hatred, self-disdain of some kind, because I hate the weak, miserable slave that I am, that I have become. So I think there's some important parallels. I do think that among those, sexual perversion is still unique. And I think the reason for that is because just the very nature of human sexuality, and by the way, it's human sexuality. Homosexuality is unnatural to human sexuality. Don't talk about homosexual monkeys. You know, praying mantises eat each other, or the female eats the male after mating. That's not natural for human beings. So it's very important that we make a distinction between human sexuality as a phenomenon in its own, as distinct from animal sexuality. But in human sexuality, I think it was so designed that there's an inborn, ingrained psychological connection between my body and myself. That is, I am my body is me. So that if I dishonor my body, I experience that as a dishonoring of me. And therefore, the self-disgust and self-hatred that we are tempted to engage in when we fail sexually, when we fall into sexual perversion, I think is a very natural and real phenomenon. And I think is at a level of intensity that would be different from simply being enslaved to some other addictive thing. There's some certain parallels, but I don't identify myself with what I consume or necessarily what I do in the same way that I identify myself with my body by God's own design. And I mean, when human sexuality is working, it's wonderful that we identify ourselves with our bodies, because then by giving you my body, I am promising my very self in the act of marriage. I'm celebrating and ratifying the commitment of our lives, of ourselves to one another, by giving our bodies to one another. So I think that's why it was designed that way. But the problem is then when we fail sexually and pervert that, it has the negative impact of particularly promoting self-loathing. I myself have been dishonored. I myself have been degraded. But I do think there's some important parallels. I've kept you late. I need to let you go. Thank you.